Good afternoon. You're listening for Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, right now it looks pretty much like a ghost town with the shelter-in-place orders out. Ain't a whole lot of people moving. I've seen no cars, but two city workmen wandering around. The guy checking the water meter, I asked him, did he have gloves and a mask? And he said, well, we got gloves but no mask, and we have to get our own. That says something about the city, I think. They don't take care of their employees. We got a mayor that is more concerned about himself than he is about anything else. All that having been said, we're going to finish up talking about strange crimes. And then we're going to talk about a few other things. You know, back in 1969, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, his daughter-in-law, Terry, was a very strange woman, let me tell you. Hired Daniel Ellsberg, a RAND Corporation and Department of Defense analyst, to compile a top-secret study of U.S. decision-making from 1945 to 1968. Now, that was the lead-up to the Vietnam War. It was a 7,000-page study, and what it did is it showed a picture of presidential failures and public deceptions about Vietnam and left Ellsberg disillusioned. A summa cum laude graduate in economics from Harvard and a former U.S. Marine infantry commander, Ellsberg made copies of the report and turned it over to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1969. He hoped to alter the course of the war. Now, we got in the war through a lie by LBJ because he wanted to move into that area. And supposedly one of our ships had been attacked. It happened in the Gulf of Tonkin. But there was no attack. Now, well, nothing happened with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and you can't expect the Senate to do anything. They can't even pass the bill to help the American citizens because Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are so busy trying to get all their pork passed to remake society in their image. They don't care about anybody else. They were rich. Why should they care? Well, nothing happened, and the fighting in Vietnam increased. Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers, as they were called, in 1971 to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and 17 other newspapers. Well, as a result of the publication of these documents, the public support of the war began to fade. The Nixon administration, in an attempt to muzzle and threaten Ellsberg, created a secret team known as the Plumbers. Their job was to plug leaks. They broke into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist in L.A. to search for his medical records. Then they filed espionage charges against him that carried a 115-year prison term. And because of the break-in and attempted bribery of the federal judge in the case, that particular judge, which was amazing, he didn't take a bribe, dismissed the case. 1972, the Plumbers carried out the Watergate burglary of the Democratic National Committee headquarters. That led to the conviction of several White House aides and the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Now, what's interesting is had there not been so many lies, none of this would have happened. Unfortunately, when in doubt, when you're in government, lie. Well, in November 2002, Portland Trailblazer star Damon Stoudemire skipped the team jet for a return trip home after a game in Seattle. He was going to drive the 150 miles himself. With teammate Rasheed Wallace in the car, Stoudemire's Humvee was stopped by the police. Not only was he speeding at more than 80 miles an hour, he also had the windows rolled down and marijuana smoke was billowing all around him. Studemeyer was charged with driving under the influence and speeding, and he paid a fine. Well, in July 2003, he was again in possession of marijuana, but had the foresight to try and hide it from the authorities this time, before he boarded his flight from Tucson to New Orleans. He carefully wrapped his stash in tinfoil and put it in his carry-on luggage. Well, the foil set off a metal detector. Studemeyer was detained by airport security, paid $250,000 in fines, and got suspended by the NBA for 3 months. Now, you got to ask yourself, how much do you want to smoke marijuana? $250,000 in fines? That's heavy. Well, let's talk about the James Younger gang. They rode into Northfield, Minnesota to rob a bank. Yeah, the townspeople, though, weren't totally in favor of that. Now, after the Civil War ended, Jesse and Frank James were in a bit of a quandary. They couldn't surrender for fear of being shot by the conquering Union Army and didn't want to ally themselves with their former enemies. So they teamed up with another group of brothers that had sided with the South, the Youngers. And together, that gang went on a violent crime spree. They robbed banks, they robbed stores, stagecoaches, individuals, and even committed murder. In 1873, they pulled off their first train robbery, killed the engineer, and stole $3,000 from the passengers. Now, this crime earned the James Younger gang a reputation as the most notorious and wanted criminals of their time. In 1876, a gang member from Minnesota suggested that his home state would be an easy target for a bank robbery. Well, they cased a lot of Minnesota banks and decided the First National Bank of Northfield was the one to do. The bank was rumored to hold a lot of Union money. They looked forward to a quick and profitable job. On the day of the robbery, Cole Younger and Clell Miller stood guard at the front door while Jesse James, Jim Younger, and Bill Stiles protected the escape route. Inside the bank, they ordered a clerk to open a safe, and he refused. A passersby noticed the commotion inside and ran off yelling the bank's being robbed. Miller and Cole Younger started shooting at him. Well, the gunfire startled the robbers and the hostages inside the bank. Frank James shot and killed the bank clerk who'd refused to open the safe. And several Northfield citizens armed themselves and took up positions around the town. As the outlaws made their escape, they were met by a barrage of bullets from the townspeople. You know, a lot of these folks were Civil War veterans. They wasn't much that startled them. Well, the wounded outlaws headed for the woods. They were lost, slowed by their injuries, tired and hungry, so they decided to split up. James Brothers headed for Dakota Territory. Charlie Pitts and the wounded Younger Brothers went west. Well, posses of angry Minnesotans were hot on the trail of Pitt and the Youngers. Search party closed in on them. Pitt was killed and the Youngers surrendered. Well, they were arrested and tried on 4 counts, including murder, attempted murder, and robbery. Well, in a plea bargain to avoid execution, the brothers pleaded guilty to the crimes. Well, the James boys escaped, kidnapped a doctor to treat their wounds, released him, and traveled to Missouri. Once there, they formed a new gang, continued a life of crimes, but there was a price on their head, and they knew it. In 1881, according to the story, Jesse James was shot and killed by the youngest member of the gang, Bob Ford. Frank James turned himself in. He got acquitted for his crimes. Now, there's also the story that the James boys were actually guardians of gold buried by the Knights of the Golden Circle. In fact, supposedly a lot of what they stole went to fund a revival of Southern efforts. We may never know. Well, from 1851 to 1888, beheading was a legal execution method in the Utah Territory. Now, those who lost their heads, so to speak, were certainly given, I guess you could say, a unique method of execution. Now, in Utah, the condemned chose their own method of execution, and there's no record of anybody ever choosing beheading. Now, the number of pirates executed in U.S. history is only 68. First U.S. state to abolish the death penalty, Michigan in 1846, when it became a state. State with the most executions in the modern era, Texas. Second place is Oklahoma. Well, the British used the term blowing from a gun for executions in India until the mid-1800s. The condemned was tied to the front of a cannon, and the cannon was fired. And assuming that the ropes holding to the front of the cannon didn't snap, the cannonball continued and the executed person didn't. The youngest person executed in U.S. history, Hannah Okuish, 12-year-old Pequot girl, hung in 1786 for the murder of a 16-year-old girl. Now, 140 countries have abolished the death penalty. 57 still have it. Canada officially abolished the death penalty in 1976, Mexico in 2005. And Texas, as a matter of interest, actually was trying to expedite the process. Where most are trying to stop it, we put in a drive-through. Crimes punishable by death in the American colonies included witchcraft, adultery, trading with the Indians, and stealing grapes. Crushing or dismemberment by an elephant was a commonly used execution method in parts of South and Southeast Asia until the 19th century, and it got harder and harder to find an elephant. Well, think of an object, any object. Chances are, at some point, somebody tried to hide drugs in it. For example, in 2013, Spanish police seized nearly 2,000 pounds of hashish hidden inside frozen sardines. Even more unusual, in 2017, a man was arrested in the United Arab Republics for trying to smuggle 5.7 million amphetamine pills stuffed inside sheep intestines. I bet the sheep looked pained. At an airport in Sydney, Australia, in 2007, Australian customs agents discovered 293 grams of ecstasy tablets hidden inside a Mr. Potato Head. 2010, some Mexican drug smugglers should have tried a little harder to hide their 105 tons of marijuana. According to CBS News, which occasionally does give accurate stories, the marijuana was wrapped in silver, gray, yellow, and red packages, each with a different logo, which authorities said were meant to identify the area in the U.S. where the shipments were to be sent. Some packages depicted a dog, another a smiley face, and one even had a scornful-looking Homer Simpson with the inscription, Vade Morara Cave, which roughly translates, I'm going to get high, dude. That might have been a little less subtle than it should have been. And maybe the stupidest drug cash award goes to the geniuses who thought that bags of pot wrapped in orange duct tape would look like carrots. What they looked like was bags of pot wrapped in orange duct tape. Now, normally, duct tape can fix anything, but they couldn't fix stupid. Well, forensic science has made some of its biggest strides in the 1990s and 2000s. But some major breakthroughs happened long before that. In AD 700, the Chinese used fingerprints on documents and on clay sculptures. Before that, ancient Babylonians were also pressing thumbprints into clay documents for business transactions. So at least a few civilizations out there clued into the idea of fingerprints being identifying marks. Then in 1248, China once again, this time for the publication of a book entitled Si Duan Yu, The Washing Away of Wrongs, which told its readers how to tell the difference between somebody who'd been strangled and somebody who'd been drowned. What makes this such a big deal is that it offers medical reasoning instead of just saying something like that they're floating in the water, there's a good chance they drowned. It's the first time anybody recorded medical reasoning being used to solve crimes. Woody Allen made the comment, organized crime in America takes in over $40 billion a year and spends very little on office supplies. Duh. In 1609, the first stirrings of forensic accounting occur when François Demille of France publishes the first treatise on systematic document examination. 1784, in Lancaster, England, some guy named John Toms had a torn piece of newspaper in his pocket. The bad news for him was that that torn newspaper fit nicely in another torn bit of newspaper found in a pistol that was used to commit a murder. Law put it together. First instance of physical matching. And Toms is convicted. Imagine that. Well, in 1911, Elmer McCurdy held up a passenger train in Oklahoma he thought was carrying a safe filled with money. It actually had just $46 and a few bottles of liquor. Police caught up with him, shot him, and dropped him off at a local funeral home. Nobody claimed the body. After curious town people began dropping by to see the McCurdy's corpse, the mortician decided he's going to make some money out of it. He embalmed McCurdy and put him on display, telling visitors to put a nickel in the corpse's mouth to cover the cost of admission. 5 years later, the corpse was stolen by somebody claiming to be his brother, but who really worked for a carnival that quickly put the body on display. Well, in 1976... the camera crew for the TV show The $6 Million Man was sitting up at a haunted house in Long Beach, California. An assistant moved what he thought was a mannequin, and the arm broke off, revealing human muscle and bone. It was McCurdy. How he got to Long Beach was a mystery, but the coroner found a penny and a ticket for a Los Angeles crime museum in his mouth. It seems McCurdy had been exhibited at carnivals, museums, and haunted houses for more than 60 years. Finally, he was sent back to Oklahoma and buried in Guthrie, Oklahoma, under 3 cubic yards of concrete to make sure nobody get at him again. Of course, nobody ever said what happened to all the nickels got put in his mouth. Well, do you know that 20,000 silver teaspoons are stolen from the Washington, D.C. Hilton every year? Can you imagine that? According to the Justice Department, 1 in 20 babies born today will serve time in prison. According to criminal law, only 3 people are necessary for a disturbance to be called a riot. So if you and 2 of your friends get into a brawl, you could actually be charged with fomenting a riot. Well, the retail industry loses more inventory to employee theft than it does to shoplifting. And the items most likely to be shoplifted from a supermarket, cigarettes, beauty aids, and batteries. Do you know if you have to pay ransom for a kidnapped victim, that is tax deductible? I think it's considered a business expense. Well, 15-year-old was charged with armed robbery when he pointed his pet boa constrictor at a man and told him to hand over all his money. They didn't say what happened to the snake. And half of all crimes are committed by people under the age of 18. And more Americans are arrested for drunk driving than for any other crime. Now, Russia has almost twice as many judges and magistrates as the United States. But the United States has 8 times as much crime. And do you know that nearly 50% of all bank robberies take place on Friday? They got to get the money for the weekend. When burglars break into a home, they usually go straight to the master bedroom. They say that's where the most goodies are found. And Al Capone's business card said he was a used furniture dealer. U.S. shoplifters steal an estimated $2 billion worth of merchandise every year. Odds that somebody caught shoplifting as a teenager is about 50%. Well, you know, according to the story, in the winter of 1846, when the Donner Party was trapped and starving in the Sierra Nevadas, they turned to cannibalism. And most of those who survived were forgiven. Society understood the terrible desperation of starvation. But nobody forgave a man named Louis Kiesberg. He was one of the few Donner Party survivors who managed to reach a set of lake cabins along with a woman named Tamsin Donner. Now, nobody knows what actually happened next, but Kiesberg is suspected of murder. Rescuers found him at the cabin boiling parts of Ms. Donner's body in a pot on a fire. He admitted he ate her and said he found her delicious, the best he'd ever eaten. Well, he wasn't convicted for his suspected crime, but he didn't do too well anyway. Briefly opened a Sacramento restaurant. Gotta wonder what the soup of the day was. But the restaurant burned to the ground. So he lived out his life in shame and poverty, despised by most folks. And when you've been convicted of, or suspected of eating your main squeeze, Tamsin Donner, it's awful hard to get a date. Well, William Mark Felt is maybe the most famous whistleblower of all time for his role in exposing the break-in of the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate in Washington, D.C. That whistleblowing led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. In 1972, he was the FBI's associate director working at the agency headquarters in Washington. And he's the one, according to the story, that met clandestinely with Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward and gave him critical leads that would unwind the Watergate scandal and Nixon's involvement in the cover-up of the break-ins. Now, the Post coverage of the break-ins and its ties to the White House eventually led to hearings before the U.S. Senate and jailing of White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman and Presidential Advisor John Ehrlichman. Woodward's anonymous key source became known as Deep Throat, a moniker given him by the Post editor Howard Simmons. And the nickname was a reference to a controversial pornographic movie. Now, Woodward refused to reveal the identity of his informant for over 33 years. May 31st, 2005, Felt, who was then retired, revealed that he was Deep Throat. He died at the age of 95 in 2008. But you have to ask yourself, was he really? Well, sometimes there are those that dedicate their life to fighting crime. Now, the Texas Commission for the Blind was set up to provide workplace support to the visually impaired. In 1999, it paid $55,000 to settle lawsuits filed by two blind employees. The commission had neglected to make Braille and large type employee manuals available to its employees. Now, you'd have thought that was a very logical thing to have expected them to do. Well, let's talk about Charles Mahuka, an anger management instructor. 1995, 32-year-old Miguel Gonzalez was ordered to attend an anger management class after he assaulted his girlfriend. Well, they showed up at the class drunk that made Mahuka, his instructor, so angry he beat Gonzalez to death. And after he was found guilty, he was sentenced to life in anger management. Duh. A German youth worker who teaches anger control, identified only as Herman K., was fined about $1,000 and given a 10-month suspended sentence. And you might ask what he was given that sentence for. Well, he punched a policeman in the face, shouting, "There's something for your mouth," after the officer ticketed his illegally parked car. Well, there's a group in Britain called Age Concern. It's devoted to concerns for the elderly. In June of 2000, a 69-year-old Englishman named Hector McDonald applied for a job at Age Concerned. He was turned down for the job because he was, get this, considered too old. Sometimes you have to wonder about people. Well, let's talk about some ludicrous lawbreakers. 33-year-old metal thief broke into an abandoned hospital one night in Devon, England. He heard police entering the building, so he hid inside an air duct. Meanwhile, a 19-year-old metal thief broke into that same hospital. He heard the police come into the building, so he hid on the roof. Turned out the two burglars hadn't heard the police. They heard each other. Neighbors heard the commotion and called the real police. Both men were arrested. Well, a 17-year-old crook tried to break into a Belfast, Ireland home by reaching through the mail slot and unlocking the door. Logical. The problem is his arm got stuck. Homeowners came home and called the police. Firefighters had to remove the door and then remove the mail slot frame from the door, but they still couldn't get the guy's arm out. He was taken to the police station, still stuck in the slot, and booked. His arm was finally freed, but he wasn't. Well, in early 2011, a snowstorm knocked out power to thousands of homes in Silver Spring, Maryland. Cody Wilkins, 25, broke into a house that still had power and stole jewelry. He also plugged in his phone charger because his place didn't have any power. Somebody came home unexpectedly, and Wilkins had to make a quick getaway. Well, the homeowner discovered this strange phone plugged into the wall. The phone led police straight to Wilkins, and pictures on the phone linked him to several other burglaries. This quote came from The Simpsons, from Nelson Muntz. Shoplifting is a victimless crime, like punching somebody in the dark. Yes, it could well be. Well, you know, recreating a human face from minimal remains seems impossible to most of us, but to forensic artists, it's an art and a science. The results of the painstaking process putting together clues to reconstruct a face are absolutely astounding. In matters of history or crime, forensic artists are helping us see the unknown. They're brought in as a last resort when clues to a crime have dried up and the victim is unknown. Now, police know they can't expect exact replicas of a deceased person's face without any other evidence. That can be virtually impossible. But they hope the artist can reconstruct enough visual detail so that somebody who knew the victim be able to identify him or her. In the U.S. alone, there are an estimated 40,000 unidentified human remains. Well, without a skull, forensic artists can't do much to recreate a face. But even if they have an incomplete or badly damaged skull, they've got a starting point. First, the forensic artist has to rebuild the skull using modeling wax. Skulls can be recreated even if significant parts, such as the occipital bone, are missing. Mirror imaging, one side of the face matches the other, can be used to fill in blanks. The mandible is the only bone whose absence can cause significant discrepancies in a recreated skull. A complex look at the angle and shape of each part of the skull helps the artist determine the shape of the face, pointing to whether the deceased had a round, oval, or square face. Microscopic examination of the pieces of the skull can show scientists where the hairline was, and even forehead creases can be seen based on muscular attachment in the area. And mathematical equations are used to ascertain the shape of the nose. Now, Carolyn Wilkinson, in her 2004 book, Forensic Facial Reconstruction, said the width of the nasal aperture at its widest point is 3/5 the overall width of the nose at its widest point. And she went on to explain how to figure out the overall shape and size of the nose based on evidence found in the skull tissue. A straight, thin nose usually has a weak glabella. That's the smooth space between the eyebrows. A broad nose will show through broad, rounded nasal bones with simple contours and a bell shape. Dental analysis of the skull shows the thickness of the lips and the width of the jaw. Biggest missing details of the face are hair and eye color. Without any DNA evidence, they're difficult to determine, and forensic artists earn up to $2,000 per skull they recreate. And it takes about 2 weeks for them to do their job. So if they got enough skulls to work with, they can make a nice living. Well, Diane Fossey was known as the Gorilla Girl and for dedicating her life to the animals. And for that, she paid the ultimate price. Now, her stepfather wanted her to go to college to get a business degree. But the San Francisco-born Fossey had some other ideas, starting with her job as an occupational therapist at a Kentucky hospital. While there, she heard a lecture by anthropologist Dr. Louis Leakey, and that turned Fossey's attention to Africa. By 1966, she had gained Leakey's support to carry out research on the endangered mountain gorillas of the Virunga Mountains of Rwanda. She founded a research center dedicated to the primates and lived with them for 18 years. She earned their trust. One of her favorite gorillas was killed and beheaded by a poacher. She began a successful international campaign to stop the slaughter. She got a PhD in Cambridge and wrote an autobiographical book called Gorillas in the Mist, which became a movie in 1988. She then went back to the Virunga Mountains to continue to struggle to save the gorillas and their habitat. December 26, 1985, her body was found mutilated by the type of machete used by poachers. Her murder remained unsolved, and poaching as well as logging continues in the gorilla habitat. Fossey may have foreseen her own death when she said, "The man who kills the animal today is the man who kills the people who get in his way tomorrow." And apparently, she was right. You know, there are worse things you can do with your phone than texting your ex after a few drinks. An intoxicated car thief in Tacoma, Washington would have gotten away had he not pocket dialed 911 twice. On the first call, the dispatcher heard a woman screaming and a man telling her to be quiet, so a unit was sent to investigate. The officer saw a car run a red light and gave chase. The man let the woman out and sped away and eluded police till the next morning when he accidentally dialed 911 again. Well, the police discovered him and a woman, both drunker and Cootie Brown, sitting in another stolen car. Police didn't have any idea until that moment that he had actually called 911 on himself. In 2012, a Lewiston, Idaho police detective got a text message on his cell phone. "You know, any, I'm looking for meth." Thought one of his fellow officers was playing a joke on him because he'd be stupid enough to text a cop about a drug deal. Well, Aaron Templeton was a drug dealer with the wrong number. Templeton, 37, knew where he could obtain a large amount of meth, so he was texting his friends asking him to pitch in to buy it. Detective agreed to pay $150, and as he drove into the parking lot and approached Templeton, he got one final text. "Well, that's weird. Cop just pulled up on me, so what's up with that?" Well, you know, some people, believe it or not, can't handle the truth. A Florida man called 911 from a store and said he'd been robbed. He was getting into his car after leaving a store when a man hit him and took $100 in cash from him. Police watched the store surveillance video, saw the victim walk out of the store and sit in his car and then go back in and call 911. When confronted, the man admitted he'd lied. He said he was afraid to go home and tell his wife he'd spent the $100. Got arrested. 2009, more than 100 friends and family of cancer patient Trista Joy Latern, 24, held a benefit in her honor at a tavern in Waco, Texas. They raised $10,000 for her, which she used to get breast augmentation surgery. Latern had lied about having cancer, even shaved her head so she'd look like she'd undergone cancer treatment. Latern told police she wanted the boob job in order to save her marriage. Well, shortly after she got arrested, her husband filed for divorce anyway. Some days you just can't win. Aaron Siebers, 29, of Denver, Colorado, used a small knife to stab himself in the legs, arms, and upper body in November 2009. Then called police and said he'd been attacked by three men who were either Hispanic or maybe skinheads. Police questioned his story, and Siebers admitted he'd faked the attack. And why, might you ask, that he faked the attack? He wanted to go to his job at a video store. Instead, he got arrested and fired. Well, we've all heard of Mrs. Butterworth and her syrup, but apparently she wasn't as wholesome as the maple syrup bottle would have you believe. In the early 1700s, Mary Butterworth was raising seven children and a family desperately needed money. Some women would have taken up sewing, but Mary Butterworth became a counterfeiter. She invented a method of counterfeiting that produced passable bills and left no incriminating evidence. First, she put a piece of damp, stretched muslin on top of the bill she wanted to copy. Then she ran a hot iron over the cloth, which caused the material to pick up a light impression of the bill. And then she ironed the muslin to transfer the pattern to a blank piece of paper in order to produce the counterfeit bill. And she used a quill pen to touch it up. The incriminating evidence, the used piece of muslin, was then burned. Well, her family members helped manufacture the money, and over 7 years, the Butterworth gang made over £1,000 worth of bogus money. That's the equivalent of about $130,000 today, and they didn't have any sophisticated technology. 1715, the five-pound note had to be recalled because there was a flood of phony bills in circulation. About that same time, authorities eyed the newly built Butterworth home with some suspicion, but they couldn't prove anything. Well, then in 1723, one of Butterworth's carpenters traveled to Rhode Island to witness the hanging of 26 pirates. At a restaurant there, he tried to pay with the counterfeit bills, but was caught by the innkeeper. After he was arrested, he revealed the details of the counterfeiting operation. Well, Mary Butterworth was arrested and put in jail, but with no hard evidence, she was released. Nobody knows whether she ever gave up counterfeiting after that. She died in 1775 at the age of 89. Apparently, she had done rather well up to that point in time. Well, there was an interesting case brought to court. The plaintiff was Renee Jolly, age 34. The defendant was the Canadian Defense Minister Art Eggleton, Citibank, and several drugstore chains. In 1999, Jolie filed a suit claiming the defendants were trying to murder him because he was a Martian. Case was dismissed. The judge said since Jolie said he wasn't human, he didn't have any status in front of the court, so he can't bring the case. And that was a smart judge. In his next case, Gerald Overstreet sued Gibson's Discount Store. In 1979, Overstreet was shopping at Gibson's, and he reached for a jar of jelly, and a rattlesnake bit him. He sued for negligence. Overstreet lost the case. The court said that a store's duty to protect its customers from wild animals doesn't begin until the store knows the animal's there. At that point, the store has a duty. Until then, they don't. Well, this next one, the plaintiff was Joan Hemmer. The defendant was Ronald Winters, owner of a chimpanzee named Mr. Jiggs. Well, Hemmer was eating at a restaurant in New Jersey when she looked up and saw Mr. Jiggs walk in, dressed in a Boy Scout uniform. She freaked out and ran, bumped into a wall, and injured her shoulder. She sued. Winters told the jury Mr. Jiggs was no danger to anybody. He was thoroughly domesticated, lived in a house, could even feed himself besides. He was actually on his way to a Boy Scout party in a restaurant. Believe it or not, the jury sided with Mr. Jiggs. So I don't guess the jig was up, so to speak. Well, Martha Stewart had a comment about her conviction. She said, I'm not supposed to say it, but I was not guilty of a crime. And in actuality, she probably wasn't, unless boring TV is a crime. She said she became a target because she was a strong, rich woman had been very successful. Well, let's look about some interesting laws. In Los Angeles, it's against the law for infants to dance in public halls. You have to go to private halls to do that. If you've just eaten garlic in Gary, Indiana, you have to wait at least 4 hours before you can attend a theater or ride on a public streetcar. Rochester, Michigan, anybody swimming in public must have their suit inspected by a police officer. What if they're not wearing a suit? In Massachusetts, it's illegal for a mourner at a funeral to eat more than 3 sandwiches. So if they have a buffet at the funeral, watch yourself. In Xenia, Ohio, it's a crime to spit on a salad bar. Well, that's pretty much a crime anywhere. In Decatur, Illinois, it's illegal to drive without a steering wheel. By law, and this is true even today, all Washington, D.C. taxis have to carry a broom and a shovel. In Louisiana, it's illegal to gargle in public. Next time you're down on Bourbon Street, watch. Winchester, Massachusetts, it's illegal for a woman to dance on a tightrope unless she's in a church. In Florida, and this is a crime, you may not pass gas in a public place after 6 p.m. So before you do, check the time. Now let's look at some celebrity cases. Singer-composer Tom Waits, sued Frito-Lay. 1988, Frito-Lay ran commercials featuring a singer that with a raspy voice that sounded like Waits. And Waits had been approached to do commercials by the same ad agency and refused. So they used an impersonator. Waits sued for voice misappropriation, claiming using his music to sell Doritos sullied his reputation with his fans. Well, believe it or not, in 1992, he got $2.4 million. First ever punitive award involving a celebrity sound-alike. Then we have John Hartman, former member of the Doobie Brothers. The defendant was Petaluma, California Police Department. He left the band to join the police force and left the police force to rejoin the band. Well, when he wanted to rejoin the force in 1994, the former drummer was turned down. He sued for discrimination, claiming that he should be classified as disabled because he'd done so many drugs in the 70s. Now, the judge ruled that Hartman hadn't done enough drugs to qualify as disabled. Well, when you hear the name Lizzie Borden, you probably think the woman who chopped up her parents. But did she really do it? The crime. Physician that I am and accustomed to all kinds of horrible sights, it sickened me to look upon the dead man's face. Nearly all the blows were delivered from behind with great rapidity. Now that quote came from the doctor that examined the dead man, Andy Borden. On August 4th, 1892, he and his wife, Abby, were brutally axe murdered in their upscale home in Fall River, Massachusetts. Police arrested their 32-year-old daughter, a Sunday school teacher named Lizzie Borden. Now, Borden pleaded not guilty, claiming that a wayward tramp had committed the murders. But the evidence against her was a little hard to explain. Her alibi, she was in the barn collecting sinkers for fishing lines, fell apart when police concluded nobody had been in the barn for days. She'd once staged a fake robbery of her father's desk and blamed it on a stranger. Well, that's better than blaming it on a friend. Says she'd removed her father's boots before his nap, but in his death photo, the boots are still on. I guess you could say he died with his boots on. And there was motive. Prosecutors argued Lizzie was afraid her stepmother Abby would inherit Andy's fortune. But if both parents died, the money'd go to Lizzie and her sister. Well, the verdict, and history kind of forgets this, was not guilty. The defense was able to show reasonable doubt. The side door had been left open so somebody could have come in. And the defense presented a witness who saw a strange man in the street right after the murders.
And key pieces of evidence, such as a recent attempt by Borden to buy poison, were ruled inadmissible. And most of all, jurors simply had a hard time believing a rich, church-going woman would commit such a brutal act. Now, Borden was free, and she did inherit her father's fortune. But the murders, near uncertainty of her innocence, would follow her to her grave. Lived out her days in Falls River and died in 1927. Nobody else was ever charged with the crime, and in fact, it's still an open case. Well, Felicia Snoop Pearson played Snoop Pearson on HBO's The Wire. In 1994, Pearson, who was 14 at the time, was convicted of second-degree murder after she shot and killed another girl in a street fight. She served 6 years and was released in 2000. By 2004, she had slid back into a life of crime, dealing drugs while working at a car wash. Her life changed when Michael Williams, who played a gangster named Omar on The Wire, spotted her in a Baltimore club. And Williams was captivated by Pearson's thug appearance. He talked The Wire's producers into giving her an audition. So they created the character of Snoop Pearson, a killer in a drug gang, for her and used her name as well. Pearson credits the show with helping her turn her life around, but casting a real-life killer as a killer on TV and using a real name to boot was painful for the family of Okia Toomer, the girl Pearson had murdered. They only learned about Pearson's new life when a family member recognized her watching The Wire. Toomer's mother, Charlene Smith, told The Washington Post, "I was devastated. It's like they're glorifying it." And certainly it could be upsetting, I guess. Well, under the category, be careful what you wish for, a courtroom is probably not the best place to exhibit sarcasm. Well, how much does Eric Torpey admire NBA legend Larry Bird? So much that when Torpey was sentenced to 30 years in prison for armed robbery and attempted murder in 2005, he looked at the judge and said, "Well, why not make it 33? That was Bird's jersey number. And the judge agreed and granted the request. However, after serving the first few years of his sentence, Torpey wasn't happy with that situation anymore. He said in 2011 interview, "Now I wish I'd said 30 instead of 33. I've wised up." Adding insult to injury, the story made the rounds in the press and Torpey was made fun of on The Tonight Show, which means that Larry Bird himself has most likely heard about it. Torpey will be eligible for parole in the year 2033, and he said, "Larry Bird must think I'm an idiot." Yeah, that's probably true. Well, let's do a quick overview of the police. On average, more fast food workers are murdered on a job than are police officers. And you know U.S. police officers are exempt from federal jury duty? TV cops shoot their guns regularly, but the average for a real cop is once every 9 years of service. New York City's first female police officers, dubbed police matrons, went to work in 1891. First U.S. city to use police cars, Akron, Ohio, in 1899. The cars were electric wagons that could go 16 miles per hour and cover 30 miles before they needed to be recharged. Well, America's most successful police dog was Trip, a Florida Golden Retriever with more than 100 arrests to his credit. Traffic police in South Korea are required by law to report all the bribes they receive. The law doesn't prohibit them from taking them. They just have to report them. And 40% of Americans believe police shows are fairly accurate. Only 14% of real police officers agree. I've seen some really strange police shows. Ted Kaczynski, child prodigy, professor, survivalist, terrorist, wordsmith. Thanks to interviews and his infamous manifestos, we got a detailed insight into a man who was justified to himself setting off several bombs from 1978 to 1995 that killed 3 people and injured 23. One of his quotes, "Never lose hope. Be persistent and stubborn and never give up. There are many instances in history where apparent losers suddenly turn and out to be the winners unexpectedly, so you should never conclude all hope is lost. Antidepressants are a means of modifying an individual's internal state in such a way as to enable him to tolerate social conditions he would otherwise find intolerable. Probably true. Legally, there's nothing to prevent us from going to live in the world like primitive people. Yeah, that's quite true as well. A Chorus of Voices exhorts kids to study science. No one stops to ask whether it's inhumane to force adolescents to spend the bulk of their time studying subjects most of them hate. Well, let's talk about the bizarre world of courtrooms. The plaintiff was Randall Dale Adams. The defendant, filmmaker Errol Morris. Now, Adams was convicted of murder in 1977. 10 years later, Morris made a film about the Adams case. The movie was called The Thin Blue Line. It presented a case for Adams' innocence so effectively he was released from prison. When he got out of prison, he sued the filmmaker for $60,000. They settled out of court. Morris agreed that Adams should receive rights to any commercial uses, notably films or books, of his life. Sometimes you don't realize when you're well off. The plaintiff in this next case, Mary Sue Stowe. Junior Davis, her ex-husband, was the defendant. When they split up, Mary wanted custody of 7 frozen embryos that had been fertilized by Junior. Case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which sided with Junior. Mary's lawyer said she was devastated by the ruling, but would try to talk one-on-one with her ex-husband to get him to change his mind. Why would he change his mind when the court had just ruled in his favor? Duh. Plaintiff, J.R. Costigan. The defendant, Bobby Mackey's Music World, a country music bar in Kentucky. Costigan claimed that a ghost punched and kicked him while he was using the bar's restroom. He sued the bar for $1,000 in damages and demanded that a sign be put on the restroom warning of the ghost's presence. Club's lawyer filed a motion to dismiss the case, citing the difficulty of getting a ghost into court to testify for the defense. Well, for some reason, the court dismissed the case. Takes all kinds. While on his deathbed after suffering a major heart attack in 2009, James Washington, an inmate in a Tennessee prison, told the guard, "I have to get something off my conscience." Washington then confessed to a 1995 murder that had gone unsolved. At the time, he was serving a 15-year sentence for a lesser crime, but shortly after his confession, Washington made that what doctors called a miraculous recovery. So he tried to take his confession back, but it was too late. Arrested and later convicted for the murder he had confessed to, the judge sentenced him to life in prison. Ever tried to smuggle exotic animals on a plane? It's not easy. Just ask the woman at a Melbourne airport who was caught with a 51 live tropical fish inside her skirt. Customs agents became suspicious when they heard flapping noises. Also in Melbourne, agents thwarted the plans of a man who thought he could smuggle 2 pigeons inside his tights. Yeah, he was wearing tights. When a suitcase went unclaimed at the Bangkok airport, agents opened it up and discovered 11 otters inside. Also in Bangkok, agents opened a man's suitcase and a bird of paradise flew out of it. After they apprehended the man, they discovered 2 pygmy monkeys hidden in his underwear. Not to be outdone, another man with a mysterious bulge was discovered with 18 tiny endangered monkeys stuffed inside his girdle. Yes, he was wearing a girdle. And finally, there was the story of a mother and daughter who came up with a novel way to get their pet macaw from Thailand to Seattle. They sedated it and hid it under the daughter's shirt to make it look like she was pregnant. Well, they got away with the crime, but unfortunately, they bragged about it later, so they were arrested. If you get away with it, shut up. Jesse Hippolyte, 23, went on a bank robbing spree in Brooklyn, New York in 2011. handing tellers a note that said, "Give me all the money or else everybody dies." Well, he never actually showed a weapon. A partial license plate number from the getaway car led cops to Hippolyte and his Facebook page. He had put a photo of himself wearing the same sweatshirt he'd worn in the robberies, holding a wad of cash. Two of his posts said, "Crime pays my bills," and "What if we all got fed up with this recession and started running inside every effing bank to give us money that belongs to us?" He got arrested. Then in June of 2011, Susan Cole of Denver, Colorado, was called for jury duty. This 56-year-old beautician didn't want to serve, so she showed up at the courthouse wearing blotchy makeup, curlers, reindeer socks, and mismatched shoes. And then she fabricated a sad story to District Judge Ann Mansfield. She said, "I broke out of domestic violence in the military, and I have a lot of repercussions. One's post-traumatic stress disorder." Mansfield, of course, immediately dismissed her. A few months later, the topic on a Denver radio talk show was how to avoid jury duty, and Cole was listening that day. Cole called in and told her, described her ruse in detail. Guess who else was listening that day? Judge Mansfield. Cole was charged with first-degree perjury. Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote Crime and Punishment. Said, "The man who has a conscience suffers whilst acknowledging his sin. That's his punishment." Yeah, well. Eugène Vidocq was a pioneering police detective of 1800s France, and part of his legacy is the Vidocq Society, a group of modern-day investigators that follow in his footsteps. September 1990, three friends in Pennsylvania, William Fleischer, a former police officer, Richard Walter, a forensic psychologist, and Frank Bender, forensic artist, founded a crime-solving club. The idea invited investigators like themselves to join the group and use their skills to solve cold cases, specifically long unsolved cases of murder and disappearance. They founded a new organization in honor of and the spirit of pioneering detective Eugene Francois Vidocq, calling it the Vidocq Society. Today, that group has more than 150 members from dozens of crime investigation fields and meet regularly, usually over long lunches, to discuss potential cases. Cases are taken on a first-come, first-served basis and are taken pro bono, meaning the members work for free. The criteria of the cases must be at least 2 years old, the victims cannot have been involved in criminal activity, and requests must be presented by legitimate law enforcement agencies at one of the club's Philadelphia luncheons. And it's become a highly suspected organization over the years. Well, this first one, Va Fortezza Medici Jail Restaurant in Volterra, Italy, it's called Convict du Jour. There are several jail-themed restaurants in the world, but this is the only one housed in a real, fully operational correction facility. Members of the staff, from waiters to cooks, are inmates doing time for crimes ranging from racketeering to murder. Under the eyes of prison guards, they prepare fancy meals for diners who undergo background checks before they're seated. And whatever you do, don't complain about the food. Well, we come to the end of another show. I hope you're enjoying your self-imposed isolation. It can get rather boring. I'm working on the second in a series of young adult books. I'll be putting them up on the internet. But until tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.